everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about everything from characters to craft to karma. Everything will be on the table because everything has to be on the table. When you write, your only limitation can be your own ceaseless imagination. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as audio and video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. Author is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their stellar yearly writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, you know, I am a very lucky man because I get to do what I love. That's pretty much all I do. And one of the things that I love to do is talk to writers. I really do. I'm always interested when I talk to writers, particularly when you listen closely. You are always more interested when you listen closely to someone. And I listened very closely when I talked to Tish Cohen almost 2 years ago, in June of 2010, about the release of her novel, her best-selling novel, The Truth About Delilah Blue. And I am lucky again because I am going to get to talk to her once more because she is with me now on Author to Author. Tish, welcome to Author.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How's it going up there in sunny Canada?
Well, it's surprisingly sunny for March. Usually we're under a few feet of snow still. So I'm actually writing outside on the porch, which is great.
Oh, how delightful. You can write outside. I can never write outside.
I can do it. You have to squint more, but I can manage to do it, yeah.
You're not distracted
by
your surroundings?
I like the people walking by and the birds and I find that sort of energizing.
Well, so when I talked to you, you had finished The Truth About Delilah Blue, and that was out. And so your writing, I assume, is it your next book, or has one come out since Delilah? I don't think one has it?
Actually, yes, a teen book has come out since Delilah, which came out just over a year ago.
Oh, okay.
Just under a year ago. And so that came out in Canada and the U.S., and now I'm working on the next adult book, which comes out next spring.
Do you alternate between doing a teen book and an adult book each year?
Well, not by design, but that's how it's worked out. But not really. So right now I'm working on actually two adult books.
Oh, really? At the same time?
Yeah, actually, there's a novella that I'm working on that actually does come out this year, that comes out in September, called The Break-In, that I'm doing as, it's a slander book. It'll probably wind up 70 pages or something, and it's meant for adults learning to read.
Really?
So it's sort of a quick read. It's highly visual, that sort of thing, to sort of keep people interested. But it'll be for sale in the bookstores as well for anybody who's looking for, you know, a sort of a light read, a quick read, that sort of thing.
How did you get involved in that project? Was that your own idea, or is that something somebody approached
you
about that?
No, I was contacted by Grassroots Publishing, and I just thought that sounded like a great sort of give back project for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it turned out to be a lot of fun to write. And it's called The Break-In, and it was inspired by a break-in at my own house. I walked into a burglary.
In the middle of it?
Yes, I walked right in, and I thought,
tell
you know,
me about it.
We've all heard a noise in the house, and we've all sort of thought, oh, you know, is someone in here? And of course, you convince yourself that you're crazy, and it's not happening. It's just your imagination. And so I waited at the door a little bit. I waited for another noise. I didn't hear one. So I went in. I brought the groceries into the kitchen. I had locked the front door. By the time I got to the kitchen, I heard from the basement below me the sound of a cupboard door slamming shut. So then I knew, okay, that didn't happen on its own. So
is there an exit from your basement?
Yes, there is. But I didn't know which exit, you know, where the person had gained entry from. I didn't know anything. So, but I did see as I was leaving, I saw there was a getaway car. There was somebody waiting.
Right at the
end of the driveway, around sort of in through the
trees.
This
was like planned.
It was planned. It was exciting. And the greatest thing is I solved the whole case on my own. I didn't leave it to the police, Bill. No.
You knew who it was?
I knew. I recognized the car, the getaway car.
Oh.
And so it was sort of someone who had my key, and so I solved the whole, I cracked the case is what I did.
You know what's funny about break-ins, like not always obviously, but and I don't know how you would ever think of this if it was happening. I know I wouldn't, because I would just be so sort of adrenalined out, you know. But they're probably, for most part, as scared of you, as scared as being of being caught or seen as you are of seeing them.
I think she was. It was a girl and her boyfriend, and I think they were petrified.
Yeah, I'm sure they were.
Being caught, yeah. Yeah.
You know what's funny? I'll bet you, this is an energetic thing, but don't you just know as soon as you walk into a house that something is wrong? I mean, can't you just feel it?
Yes, and I think also if you're buying or renting a house, I think you can tell like there's an energy to a house too.
Mm-hmm.
If bad things have happened there.
Do you want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
This is a true story. Okay, so we were looking. I own a house, and I've owned it since 2001, and it's the only house I've owned. But we've been renting, and we decided, okay, it's time to buy a house. So we're looking around. And my wife's just had a baby, our second son. And so she was in a highly emotional state in general, because she'd had a very difficult delivery but she'd survived. And so it was just a very emotional time. And we decided to move, like when the kid, we were still toting him around in a carrying, you know, one of those car seats. It was so small.
Yeah.
So we go to this house, the real estate agent says, oh, you got to see this house. And it was huge. You know, it was in our price range, but it was enormous. It wasn't in a great neighborhood, really. There was like a barking dog and a chain link fence kind of thing, but it was enormous.
Right.
And had a huge daylight basement. And Jen's, my wife's an artist, so it was perfect for painting. And the upstairs was like, I don't know, 2,000 square feet, which in Seattle, I was a waiter at the time, you know, this was incredible that we could find it. I was like, oh, wow, we should just go for it. I know the neighborhood's not great, but whatever. We'll never see anything this big and this spacious and the huge backyard.
Sure, that's tempting.
Right? You know, why not?
Yeah.
Just a touch more than we want to spend, but you know how that goes when you're – so I get Jen and I bring her over, and the real estate agent's telling us about the place. She says, well, you know, there's only been one owner. That's the nice part. They lived in there since 1950 when it was built. And they just passed away, and the son's selling it. And I thought, well, okay. And we walk in, and Jen has to leave immediately. She walked into the kitchen, and she says, I can't be here. I can't be here. She said, I don't know. And she left the house and started to cry. And she said, I don't know what went on in that house. I don't know what pain those people knew, that family. She said, but I felt like the mother was in that kitchen with me, and I can't spend a moment in there.
Wow.
And that was that. And I had to explain that to my real estate agent somehow. But she had essentially – and the sons were heavy. You know, they were very sad, clearly. The parents had just died. But my wife just said she could feel it throughout the entire house.
Wow.
That it was, you know, whether you believe in that sort of thing, but she said, I am out of here. There's no way on God's green earth you get – I don't care what they charge for this thing. I'm not living in that house. And
wow.
Thank God.
No, well, that's important to listen to that.
Isn't it? Isn't it? And in fact, funny end to the story, we eventually did find a house, not that far from it. But we didn't have a lot of money, and I'm driving along. And you see, you've got to learn to trust your intuition no matter what you're doing. For writing, God knows you have to trust your intuition when you pick your projects and when you're following your story and that sort of thing.
Well, humans, I think, are the only beings that don't listen to their intuition. Animals
don't
do.
Yes, absolutely.
Think about that.
But you do, don't you? You
well,
do.
Yeah, I do. Sometimes I have ignored it, but I'm trying to, you know, I've learned to listen to it.
Well, you have to. And I was driving along this street, and it was kind of tree-lined, and I thought, and it was a little busier, but it was very pretty. I thought, I bet we could get a house here. And the next day, I saw a for sale by owner on the very street. I said, I thought we could get it. And I walked in and I said, this is it. And we bought it that day.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Christmas point, ding, ding, ding. So there you go.
Manhattan, this one had good energy.
It had great energy. It had great energy, a beautiful backyard and all these kinds of things. Yeah, energy is very important, I think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think a house can carry that.
You know, it's fine. When we did our interview, we talked, and I want to talk about it again, your unusual beginning to sort of your writing life. You were a young girl, And I'm trying to remember the whole story now, but you had you sort of plagiarized Peanuts? Was that what I'm, was, am I, am I remembering?
I was always drawing. And right. So I had drawn, and I loved dogs. So, and of course, Snoopy was my one of my favorite. You know, he was my idol. And so I was drawing Snoopy on one of the cardboards from my dad's dry cleaning from his shirts, mm-hmm. And I drawn Snoopy, and I was quite proud of this drawing. I thought it was a fine likeness. And I was sitting actually in my sister's closet, which is sort of a large closet, and I sort of was struck by the sense that, or the sort of knowledge that I'm supposed to write, and I was supposed to write a story about this, and I was supposed to write about all the things that I draw, and I knew that I couldn't write about Snoopy. That was against the law.
It had already been done.
That was going to get me into trouble, but I did know that I was meant to write, and so I didn't trust myself, though. I thought, you know what, writing stories, that's for special people. It's not going to work out for me. And so I put Snoopy away, and I didn't entertain the thought of writing again for about 20 years, or maybe 15 years. Yeah.
You know, that is a very familiar story, you know, more so than you would guess amongst writers who, first of all, it's so interesting. We were just talking about intuition. And how do you know? You know, how do you know that you... that you're supposed to do this, but you do. You did know that much, but you questioned it, of course.
Yeah. And I think you have to listen to that. And I think you have to be very honest with yourself, because later when I was an adult, I was torn, but you know, between different paths that I might take career-wise. And one of them was art, painting, and that sort of thing. And I wanted to do it. I had the desire. I wanted that lifestyle. I loved painting and drawing. But I knew I wasn't, I was good at it. I was maybe better than the average person, but I wasn't great at it. And to make a career out of art, you know, in the art world, I needed to be great. And so I was honest with myself about that. You know, so I think it's important to sort of differentiate between intuition and desire.
Do you think you're great at writing?
No.
But yet you were willing to...
Is there a writer on earth who thinks they're great at writing?
I don't know. No, you just do the best you can. But you were willing to pursue that.
I was willing to pursue that because I had I know it to my toes kind of feeling about it that I didn't have with art.
Yeah. Well, it's very important. My wife's an artist, and she taught me something very early on about all the arts, really. She showed me her work. She had, because she had gotten a degree in writing from college, and then she wanted to go back to school for art because she wanted to be able to illustrate the stories she wrote. She wanted to write for children, and she showed me the work that she submitted to the art school, and I thought at the time, like, wow, I could have done that, and I wasn't. That was okay. It was really. Not to knock her, but it was really nothing. There was nothing about it which said this person's going to be a great artist. But what she said to me was, any monkey can learn to draw. It's easy learning to draw. Having something you want to draw, that's the tricky part. And she had something from the get-go she wanted to draw. So once she had the sort of skill, and art is particularly that way, there is certain, you know, you got to learn about shading and proportion and all that crap. Once you had that down, she was set to go because she always had something she wanted to draw. And she saw a lot of kids who came in with certain technical facility but really struggled because they didn't have something they actually – because you've got to draw something, right? You've got to have a story you want to tell.
I think in art it's sort of parallels what you need to make it in writing. And in writing what you need – because you can learn plot, you can learn character development, you can learn you can learn all the structural pieces, but you can't really learn voice. You have your own voice. You can develop your voice, and you can take it further, but it really is your voice. And that's the one thing that editors, that's the magic piece that's what editors and agents and everybody's desperate for, is just a fresh new voice. And with art, if you think about it, it's the same thing, and I maybe it's not, we wouldn't call it voice, but we call it something else. But it's that artist personality that comes into it, which separates the, you know, three people can draw a building, they can all draw it beautifully, but what separates one of them?
Oh, there's a great Picasso quote. which he said, and I'm going to butcher it, but he said, the job of the artist is not to have to draw a yellow circle. You don't draw the circle, the yellow circle on the page can't represent the sun. Oh, I don't remember it. Rats, it was so good, too, but I'm going to screw it up and it won't be worth it. I should Google it while... I could actually do it while I talk to you. I'm going to go Picasso drawing the sun. See, this is... We're so internet savvy. But about voice, I think that a lot of that comes from knowing knowing the story you really want to tell.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that, here it is. There are painters who transform the sun to a yellow spot, but there are others who, with the help of their art and their intelligence, transform a yellow spot into the sun.
Right, that's perfect.
Oh, he was so good. But you can't replace, all the craft in the world is not going to replace having a story you're actually dying to tell. It's irreplaceable.
Yeah, for sure.
You know. What was your first novel that you... Oh, you wrote your first novel in 3 weeks or something crazy like that, wasn't...
Well, okay, this wasn't... It was my first novel that was to be published. So there were a couple of novels before... There were three novels, actually, before that didn't make it. But so that one, it was my last effort. It was my sort of, you know, sink or swim. If this one doesn't make it, I will accept that it's not meant to be, and I'll move on to a less soul-crushing career. Actually, I was going to fill out an application to work at The Gap. They won't reject me. I won't be frightened of the mailbox anymore. I can do this. But so I had an outline that was very, very detailed, and it was probably a 30-page outline, so a chapter outline. So I knew I had sort of lived the book a little bit before I sat down to write it. I basically took, it was about 3.5 weeks to write the first draft. So that's a dirty first draft. And that's, I probably worked 18-hour days. You know, I didn't really... there was not much eating or sleeping. But I was desperate to make it. And as I was writing, you know, I had made this sign that I may have told you about before, and I taped it to my monitor, and it said, "This is the book." And I just believed it to my toes. This is the book. This is the one. And so I wrote with that, like fully believing that, and then sent it to my agent. And there was 7.5 months of editing. So it wasn't as dramatic as it sounds. It really
you sent that first
getting that
draft?
First draft down.
You sent the first draft to her or him?
To my agent, yeah.
Oh, you didn't rewrite it before you sent it to them?
I probably read it over or something beforehand and made some adjustments, but I gave it to my agent, and then but typical, you know, in the early stages of my career, we worked quite closely on books before they went out to editors. And so, and anyway, it wound up paying off. It wound up, you know, selling. So it was just pure desperation that I wrote it that quickly. I had to have it finished. I had to prove to myself that I could do it. And so that's what it was. It was, you know, it was desperation.
You know, sometimes I've known other writers who have that sort of ultimatum thing they give themselves. Not always. I've seen the opposite, too. But where they sort of say, okay, this is it. And it can bring a clarity to yourself. Do you really want this thing or not? I mean, I wonder if that hadn't worked, if you really would have bagged it or not.
I don't know if I could have, but I mean, if it were going on for years and years, the rejection, I guess I would have. I had two books go out to editors, agented books go out to editors before Townhouse, and I think what kept me going were the editor's comments. There was enough that was encouraging that I kept going. Yeah. Had they been flat rejections and form letters and everything else, I don't think I would have. I don't think I maybe would have had the confidence to keep going, but there was enough in it. So I listened to that, and I took all the rejection letters. Every time, you know, I would allow myself one day to weep, when I got a rejection. Right. And then and then the next day I had to take that letter, learn from it, and generally I'd be working on the next book, so I would apply it to the next book.
Yeah, good for you. You know, have you seen your work? How has your work changed, do you think, since you published Townhouse? How has your relationship to it changed?
It's tougher now to have that sort of free time to work on a book. So time, like having enough time to work on a book is, you know, as much as I would like to, and finish a book as quickly as I would like to. And when I say quickly, you know, I've been working on the book that I'm working on now for a year and a half. So it's no three and a half week endeavor.
Right.
So yeah, there's just a lot of distractions. I think I have 7 books out, and then 2 that are in the pipeline right now, and then three that are in development as films. So there tends to be a lot of stuff happening on the side.
Wow. So this is the business of being not just a writer, but an author, really.
Yes. Yes.
And do you like the author part of it? Is there anything?
I do. I've come to it used to terrify me. I used to be afraid of the speaking in public and the interviews and things like that, but not anymore. Now I enjoy them. I don't get nervous anymore. It doesn't matter if I'm speaking to 3 people or 1,000 people, you know.
Oh, really?
I'm comfortable. I love to do it. And I do enjoy that. I do enjoy it. And there are fun things I'll get to do. You know, I got to two of my books were in the at the Toronto Film Festival in the swag bags for celebs, so I got to spend the day meeting celebrities, and you know, so sometimes there's exciting things like that to do. And so
let me ask you this one. Here's something I didn't get to ask you because I wasn't asking it back then, but I'm going to ask it of you now, which is, so I want you to finish a sentence for me, all right?
Okay.
And this is the sentence. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
Discipline, I would say.
Were you disciplined?
Writing is an art, yes. However, you can't approach it with the attitude that I'll get to it when I feel like it. I'll get to it when I'm inspired, when I'm feeling creative. You know, if I waited for that, then I'd put out one book in my entire life.
Right.
Over the first of my lifetime. So I think the discipline and the, seat in the chair sort of mentality.
That's really true. There's somebody, there's a guy named Michael Neal, who's a great teacher. He's kind of like a life coach guy. And he talked about the difference, and I think this was really astute on his part. He talked about the difference between mood and desire. And mood is going to be a reflection, in a way, of the story you're telling yourself about the day's events. And so whether you're feeling good or bad is going to be the sort of little narrative that's running in your head as you go along your life. Your husband said this to you, or your kids did this, or your agent said whatever. And so your mood goes up and down with these, depending on what you say about it. And that is going to fluctuate, as all moods do. They're transitory. But then there is your desire, which, if you love to write and it's something that you've always wanted to do, that desire is pretty much everlasting. You know, if it's the real thing, if it's an authentic, it's just there. It's always there. And all you need to do, if it's a true desire, is quiet yourself, let the voices of the story of your day silence and get still, and then that desire sort of rises up. It's always there. It never goes away. And suddenly, after maybe a minute or 30 minutes or an hour sometimes, you're inspired, lo and behold.
No, I agree. And in fact, I think that writer's block is really the inability to still yourself. I think that's it is.
I totally agree. Christopher Morris, he's the... So he said something I thought that was thought really good and to the point, which is writer's block is when we give fear a name.
Yeah.
Right,
because it's always terrifying.
Sure, it's the blank page.
It's always
page,
easy to avoid it.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, the blank page is great because you can put anything you want on it. It's just as blank for you as it was for Shakespeare, you know?
Right.
It's no more blank. But that is what we...
Mine might be blanker than Shakespeare's.
No, I don't... Not when it starts. Not when there's nothing on it. It's blank, you know?
Right.
But But you, and that's, I think, what draws us to it, which is I get to put whatever I want there. I get to say what is correct and what is incorrect, what is good and what is bad. And that's the scary part.
Right. You know, sure, it is. Terrifying.
Yeah, it can be.
And every book is the same. Every book, it happens again.
Yeah. Oh, you know who else said that? Alice Hoffman. You know Alice Hoffman?
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Right?
She said,
I couldn't, I was talking to her about Meryl Streep, who is one of my favorite stories, but Meryl Streep had, I heard her interviewed about The Hours. Remember that movie?
Yes,
about,
love it. I love the book.
Right? She said, I couldn't believe anybody want me to be in a movie. This is Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep. And
That's a true artist, right?
Right? So she's still insecure.
That's the soul of an artist. They can never believe it, and she probably still can't believe it.
If she didn't believe it then, what's to think she believes it now? And I told that story to Alice Hoffman, and she said, I totally agree. She said, every book I start, I think, I don't know how to write a book. You know how many books she's written?
Wow. Yep. That's like exactly what I think, so that makes me feel great.
That's right. You're in good company. I love it when I talk to new writers about that because, you know, they'll say, because a lot of these same writers will talk about how they're in the middle of a book and they think, oh, God, this thing's a disaster. I'm never going to pull it together, you know, and it turns out to be a bestseller. And almost everything experienced writers, all their fears and concerns, just like you have, are the same fears and concerns, really, that beginning writers have. You know,
I think so, yeah.
I don't know how to write.
I think so.
But you, you have learned or are learning that to become comfortable with that, right?
Well, I'm used to it. I'm not shocked when it happens. I'm not as I'm not as terrified by the fear of a new book. I know that with every book, I think I've forgotten how to do this.
Right. Do you remember the last time you told yourself that? Does that help you get through?
Oh, what? Last week?
Oh, so you start a new book
every
day. Oh, God, I don't know how to do this. Do you ever say, wait a minute, that's what I said about the last one?
I tell myself that, but I rarely believe it.
Right, because
I tell myself I still feel it, and I still fear it, and I still will avoid settling down and getting to work. This is the greatest fitness program on earth. Become a writer, because in your quest to find things to distract yourself, you go to the gym. And the gym is a wonderful way to put off writing until I don't have to write at 8:30 in the morning. I can write at 10:30 or 11 because I should go to the gym first. And the gym becomes instead of something to whine about, it becomes a great, wonderful distraction.
That's right. Well, you know what it is? This is one of my new truisms, which is fear can never be disproven and love can never be proven. So there is not enough evidence in the world to disprove your fear that you can't write this book. And you can never prove to anyone that you love something. That's, you simply do or you don't.
Right.
I should say, I have a caller. I see you're there and I'm sorry, but I'm our show's almost over. So I don't have time to get you on. I apologize. I've just a few more minutes, just another minute or so to talk to Tish. Well, tell us for our listeners, so I mentioned The Truth About Delilah Blue, but tell them what they should run out and buy if they need a new Tish Cohen book.
Well, the latest is, as I said, is called Switch, and it's young adult. So it's a story about a girl who
Teen young adult?
Sorry?
Is it teen young adult?
Yes. Teen is young adult. So, yes, yeah, a story about two – it's sort of a dark take on a Freaky Friday story. So two teenage girls switch bodies.
Excellent. And so you've got the novella that's coming out or is out?
The novella comes out in September, called The Break-In.
The Break-In, excellent. And your next adult novel will be?
Next adult novel will be next May, and we're still working on the title, working/arguing about the title.
Okay. Well, Switch, everybody, Truth About Delilah Blue and The Break-In. Pick them up. She's excellent. They're excellent. Well, Tish, thank you so much. It's been a treat, as always.
Thank you, Bill. It's been great fun.
Well, and thank you, everybody, for listening in. Remember, as always, just do what you love. I'm so lucky, but you're lucky, too. Everyone can do what they love, and there's nothing better for you, too.
you love, eat what you love, talk about what you love, all there for you.
Thanks again.